This is Daryl and Jeff. We like movies and music. Some people would even call us buffs, but we wouldn't go that far. First we'll talk about a movie, and later on we'll talk about a record. Sometimes we fight, but usually we don't fight too bad. Mostly we stay friends. Mostly we stay friends.
So Jeff has just admitted to finally figuring out where to put the microphone.
It's in front of my mouth.
Yeah, that's where it goes. That's how most people do it.
I was telling Daryl I used to just put it in the vicinity of my face, and then I just, put my mouth up to the mic, but then eventually I get tired of sitting that way and I'd drift away from the mic like that.
Mm-hmm. And then I would have to point at you while we're doing the show and be like,
I didn't realize I have to put it in the perfect spot.
That is crazy to me that that took you a year and a half to deduce that putting the microphone in the right spot makes it easier to do the show. Today we are talking about Groundhog Day, and we are talking about The Smiths, Queen is Dead. Mm-hmm. So do a plot synopsis of Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day is about Phil Connors.
I feel like Murray is always weighed down by the worst character names.
It's Phil Connors, I think, and he's a TV weatherman. He's not a happy guy. He's kind of a bitter, grumpy dude, and he goes to Pensatani, I think it's Pawsatucky, some name like that, Pennsylvania.
Punk's a hunky.
Where they do a Groundhog Day ceremony, and he keeps waking up in the same day over and over and over and over again.
Unexplained.
Yeah. I think that's one of the strengths of the movie, is that they don't really,
don't bother trying to be real.
Yeah, or, have any sort of scientific, that he doesn't get hit by lightning, or he doesn't trip and fall, or I don't know if tripping and falling would make you wake up the same day, but I think that not addressing that makes the movie better.
Yeah, 100%.
Because if they got bogged down in the science of how that would work, it would be less good.
I bet you producers or the movie studio or whatever, I bet you they wanted the director to do that. Ivan Reitman.
I read a thing too, not related, but well, sort of related, but that they were originally going to do the movie where it wasn't even going to have that lead up to him arriving in this town and all this stuff and sort of set up the character. They were just going to have him start waking up on the same day.
That would work fine too, actually. Make it a little quicker. They don't really need that setup other than...
I think it works though. You got to establish that he's a jerk and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
How'd you feel about this movie?
Well, we didn't do plot synopsis for you.
We mostly did. He keeps waking up. He tries to kill himself. He tries to make out with lots of girls. He basically
tries to explain himself to people who aren't experiencing the same thing.
Yeah, he does everything that someone who is immortal and living on the same day over and over might do, and eventually settles on self-betterment and helping other people. And then that's sort of the way the movie goes.
I wonder if there's anything religious about it or philosophical.
Are you being sarcastic?
Well, I wonder if they're just I wonder if there's any thought actually put to that.
I think that there's definitely a moral to the movie and a philosophy about approaching life generally.
I also wouldn't put it past 90s movies to just sort of haphazardly. He's a better person now, so everything's good.
Yeah, I think that's honestly the like the moral of the movie. And they talk about it like it's like he asks those guys who are like from that town, being like, what would you do if you woke up in the same place every day and every day was exactly the same? And basically being like, that's, you know, he's referencing his life, but the what you're meant to make the leap of is that this that is those people's lives who are from this small town, etc. Mm-hmm. And then eventually what he settles on doing is just being a good person every day and doing the best things he can. And that's like, I don't know if you're meant to like, basically once he does that, like the spell kind of breaks, whatever spell is on him. And like, they don't really go into an explanation of that, and the two aren't necessarily connected, but I think that you're meant to draw that connection as an audience, that like he reaches a certain level of self-improvement. And like,
it's essentially like an Ebenezer Scrooge story.
Yeah, it's 100%.
Which is interesting, because a couple years before that he did Scrooge, which was terrible. It was almost like a redo.
Yeah.
A mulligan.
Okay, what do you think of the movie?
Probably, I feel like I feel the same way about the movie as you do, in that it's not the funniest thing I've ever seen, but, you know, Bill Murray pretty much wins you over, and it's pretty watchable.
Yeah, yes. When it is funny, it's pretty funny. Like, there's a couple really good jokes, and Bill Murray has a way of, like, elevating things to a level of funny, even when there's not, like, writing for it necessarily. Like, he always makes it humorous and, like, enjoyable to watch.
I also think that there's sort of an underrated thing. It's something you wouldn't really notice, but I feel like the editing of the movie is really good.
Yeah, well, we talked about that a little bit when it was happening. They keep being able...
They repeat the things, the certain things that he would experience every day over and over. They repeat those things enough for them to be established, but not too much where it gets tired.
Yeah.
And then they interject...
And they get to use montages in, like, a more interesting way than your average movie gets. So they have, like, his, like, messing around montage when he's like going on dates with girls and he's dressing up as Clint Eastwood, and then they have like the montage of him trying to like date Andy McDowell and like get to know her better,
and that's a good way to sort of make it interesting, and they interject like one-off scenes like him watching Jeopardy and knowing every answer.
Yeah, kind of thing. And then they like do like the montage scene of him committing suicide and then sort of towards the end like the montage scene of him helping people, like trying to rescue that old guy and like saving the kid out of the tree and all that kind of stuff, which is actually a funny scene, too.
Yeah. Where he's like, what do you say? What do you say? Not once have you thanked me.
I mean, he's like, I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah. Maybe.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's like, it's just a well-made movie based on an interesting premise with enough funny moments and goodwill towards Bill Murray. I think that's basically enough to make it a classic.
Yeah. I also think that like we talked about, it sort of defies easy categorization in an interesting way. Like it's
kind of
ostensibly
rom-com.
A rom-com. Like that's what it like would be billed as in some capacity.
There's kind of too much solo Murray though.
Yeah. And then, and which is what like elevates it beyond level. I'm not trying to like, but oftentimes in rom-coms, they like make these really awful female leads that are like unbearable characters, and they can avoid that because Andy McDowell doesn't get a lot of screen time.
Yeah, she just serves, they avoid it by doing something even worse to
but she just serves as a foil to like Murray and like his crisis. But I think that they like approach like that situation in the most like I feel like Ivan Reitman is Ivan Reitman, right?
Yeah.
Is like a relatively down-to-earth dude who just...
Could be Yvonne.
Sat there and was like, here are things that you might do if this situation really did present itself. And like as a consequence, Bill Murray's arc in that movie seems like really realistic and pretty funny and pretty like...
He goes through all the sort of Murray behaviors too, like the sad sack, the over-the-top screaming, you know, Caddyshack sort of craziness.
Yeah.
Especially when he's like driving with the groundhog.
Well, I think we talked about this when we were watching it, but I think one of Bill Murray's strengths is to take like a really absurd situation and like deadpan it as if it's like, so he's giving the groundhog, like the groundhog is driving the car and he's like giving him driving instructions, being like, you got to check your mirrors and like, you know, go lighter on the gas, and whatever he's saying, like, is it's like how he succeeds, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
And I could watch Bill Murray sort of accidentally step in an ice puddle over and over again all day.
Where do you want to take this conversation? What do you want to say about Groundhog Day?
Did you know one thing I mentioned earlier?
Yeah, were you the Ivan Reitman Murray beef?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know, like, there's nothing on sort of how that actually started, but I mean, they were good friends from Ghostbusters.
Yeah, maybe we should just say what it is, and then if anyone knows, they can tweet us. Yeah. But yeah, so Reitman plays Egon.
Never tweet.
Egon in Ghostbusters, and Murray plays whatever his character's name is. I can't remember.
Yeah.
And they're pals, and they grew up doing stuff together, and then for whatever reason, this movie ruined their relationship for 10 years. Like, they didn't speak for 10 years after
I read that Murray was, like, hard to deal with on set and stuff like that.
Yeah, I can imagine that, but I can also imagine, like, why or what he would have been upset about. Maybe he was, like...
You know, he had a nickname. Dan Aykroyd called him Murricane.
Really?
Because of, like, his mood swings and stuff.
He'd have bad attitude?
Yeah.
Okay.
I suspect that he's probably not like that anymore, but I also suspect that the reason for that is because he just does whatever he wants to now.
Yeah.
An interesting thing about this movie is, maybe you read this, but he didn't want to deal with producers or the movie studio. Like, he didn't want to get any, you know, professional acting tips or anything like that. You know, like, he didn't want to deal with them at all. And they probably wanted him to, like, play scenes certain ways and, like, get all in his business. So they made him hire a personal assistant so that they could relay these messages to this assistant, and then they would, you know, they would be the middleman essentially. And so Bill Murray agreed, but hired a deaf person who only only, like, could communicate with sign language. Pretty good.
Oh man. Would you say? So we decided to do this movie in part because it was, like, a good segue into, like, the Very Murray Christmas special that just got put out on Netflix, which you've watched, which I've not watched. So let's not talk in detail about that. But the thing,
pretty good though.
I don't think Murray's ever really had, like, a very down part of his career, which is kind of an interesting career.
I think mid-90s was bad for him.
But this is mid-90s. This is, like, 93.
I think after this movie, though.
Sure.
After this movie, he had a dip until Rushmore.
So, but that's, like, even, like, that's still, like, a 5-year dip.
And he wasn't in any movies after. He had a 4-year dip. He wasn't even in anything in the 80s.
Sure. I guess, like, he seems to, like, have, like, 5-year cycles, though, as opposed to, like, a 15-year cycle where he does, like, you know, he's really famous for a little and then just takes this huge nosedive and,
like,
then reappears.
Like a Chevy Chase.
Yeah. Like, he did all those, like, sort of 70s comedies, like Meatballs, and, like, does Ghostbusters in, like, the mid-80s, and then does Groundhog Day, and then comes back, resurfaces in Rushmore, comes back for Lost in Translation, which is about 5 or 6 years after Rushmore, and now he's sort of, like, going stronger than ever. Although that movie he was just in
got... He's just a meme now, though. Like,
Yeah. Well, he can just exist on being Bill Murray at this point.
Yeah.
But what's the newest one he just did that got really panned, where he's, like, in Afghanistan with some pop star, and it's really... It seems, like, very culturally insensitive.
I feel like the word rock.
The Casbah. That's what it is. Yeah. Named after the Clash track.
You know, I've never seen any of those early Bill Murray comedies, classics.
Like Stripes or Meatballs.
Haven't seen Stripes, haven't seen Meatballs, Caddyshack.
Caddyshack's a bit of a weird one. I've seen Stripes, Meatballs, and Caddyshack.
I feel like I probably wouldn't... Do you think I'd like any of those?
So we've talked about this when we've talked about comedies a lot, which is... the problem with, like, 80s comedies and early, like, it gets better in the 90s, and then with the, like, advent of the Apatow comedies goes away. But the movies just felt this obligation to, like, have a plot and have all this, so they don't have a whole lot of jokes.
Right.
So there's, like, Murray has, like, 6 or 7 really funny jokes in Stripes where you're like, that's great, that's really funny. Mm-hmm. But they don't even, like, he obviously has a lot of screen time, but so much of that screen time is, like, dedicated to, like, serving the plot, or, like, you know, in 80s comedies, just, like, showing boobs.
Right.
And, like, that's, like, a big, like, you know, you had to have all those pieces, so you couldn't just have it be, like, joke after joke where Murray's just lighting it up.
And there wasn't really any, like, nuance or self-awareness back then. It was just sort of, like, clown
Murray
activity.
Always seems a little bit to know that he's, like, kind of, like, I mean, that's sort of been his skill from day one, is to phone it in an odd way. But, like, he's not a dominant, like...
That's sort of why people, like, love him in the same way as they don't really care about other, like, 70s and 80s. Like, who cares about Chevy Chase these days?
Yeah, no one. Well, Chevy Chase wasn't even really funny in his day. Like, or you don't watch Chevy Chase. Like, if you watch, like, Bill Murray's best jokes from Stripes and best jokes from those old movies are still legitimately funny. Whereas, like, Chevy Chase is, like, hit and miss.
Even someone like Steve Martin. Like, no one's paying attention to Steve Martin these
but
days.
But is Steve Martin funny? Like, do you watch that stuff and think it's funny anymore?
No, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, that's the...
Like, Bill Murray seemed to have, like, a more modern comedy going on. Yeah. Like, he was kind of ahead of his time or whatever.
I've seen Ghostbusters, but I think I saw it when I was a kid. I don't even
Well, Ghostbusters is weird, too, because it's like an action-adventure comedy with, you know what I mean? It's,
yeah.
Like, Bill Murray is one of four Ghostbusters.
It's ensemble.
Yeah. So he gets, like, five jokes, and he's, like, the only guy who's, like, really making jokes, kind of. Like, Aykroyd makes a few, but Aykroyd is not funny. You know what I mean?
Exactly, yeah.
So, like, it's most... You know what movie is, like, the pinnacle of just not funny?
Celtic Pride,
the Blue or Blues Brothers.
Oh yeah, I hate Blues Brothers.
You're just like, what even is it? Like, it's barely an SNL sketch.
It's two of my most hated things.
Yeah, blues,
which is bad comedy and blues music.
Oh god, you know what movie is kind of funny though from that era that like does have good jokes? Animal House.
We were gonna do that on this show.
I stand behind Animal House. And yeah, I stand behind this one. You should watch some of those Bill Murray. Caddyshack's a weird one because, like, it's sort of, it doesn't really have a plot. So it's like this weird, like, meandering, almost sketch thing that is, like, funny at some points, but not really. Like, Dangerfield is barely funny. Chevy right. Chase is barely funny. Bill Murray plays, like, basically, like,
apparently every one of his lines was ad-libbed.
He's just like this guy who's after gophers and like has some sort of speech impediment and learning disability, and that's the joke.
Right.
But yeah, it's weird.
Late 80s, early 90s, Murray is an interesting
time
because he basically pulls these movies across the finish line.
Yeah. Well, what was the one we
talked about? Scrooge is terrible.
Yeah, Scrooge sucks.
What About Bob is pretty good.
Yeah, he's funny in What About Bob. I like watching him, like, I almost feel like he's legitimately messing with Dreyfuss, and Dreyfuss
They hated each other on set.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what, I think that is why it's good.
And that vibe comes through. I was gonna say...
It's a bad movie.
Yeah, it's not good. Space Jam sucks, too, but he's really funny in it.
Yeah, I love that he's in it.
He's in it for, like, two scenes, and they're the best scenes.
I remember when he announced that he was going to join the NBA. He had a press conference or something, and I was like, whoa!
Let's play a scene. This is the one where Bill Murray's saying that he's a god and sort of walks around the diner with Andy McDowell.
God.
Yeah, not the god.
What was that again?
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god. I'm not the god. I don't think.
Because you survived a car wreck? You folks ready to order?
I didn't just survive a wreck. I wasn't just blown up yesterday. I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted and burned.
Oh, really?
And every morning I wake up without a scratch on me, not a dent in the fender. I am an immortal.
Special today is blueberry waffles.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I want you to believe in me.
You're not a god. You can take my word for it. This is 12 years of Catholic school talking.
I could come back if you're not ready.
How do you know I'm not a god?
Oh, please.
How do you know?
Because it's not possible.
I'll come back.
Doris. This is Doris. Her brother-in-law, Carl, owns this diner. She's worked here since she was 17. More than anything else in her life, she wants to see Paris before she dies.
Oh, boy, what
are you doing?
This is Debbie Kleiser and her fiancé, Fred.
Do I know you?
They're supposed to be getting married this afternoon, but Debbie is having second thoughts.
What?
Lovely ring.
This is Bill. He's been a waiter for 3 years since he left Penn State and had to get work. He likes the town, he paints toy soldiers, and he's gay.
I am.
This is Gus. He hates his life here. He wishes he stayed in the Navy.
Well, I could have retired on half pay after 20 years.
Excuse me? Is this some kind of trick?
Well, maybe the real God uses tricks. You know, maybe he's not omnipotent. He's just been around so long, he knows everything.
Oh, okay. Well, who's that?
This is Tom. He worked in the coal mine until they closed the town.
And her?
It's Alice. Came over here from Ireland when she was a baby. She lived in Erie most of her life.
He's right. And her?
Nancy. She works in the dress shop and makes noises like a chipmunk when she gets real excited.
Hey!
It's true.
How do you know these people?
I told you. I know everything. In about 5 seconds...
All right, and then some plates fall.
There's something really comforting about Bill Murray's voice.
Yeah, man. I don't know what it is. I was saying to... We mentioned this, but like... I think the strength of this movie resides in like Bill Murray being awesome and the writing being like I don't know if legitimate is the right word, but like it does feel very real. Like this feels like it's obviously a real town. They went and shot it somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it feels like this is exactly what you would do if presented in this absurd situation. So like that realness lends it like a gravitas that like carries it. That's a bit cheesy, but you know what I'm trying to say. Like
it's approachable.
And it never like its concept is so absurd that like it doesn't,
you get over it really quickly.
Yeah. And then it just grounds itself in like the practicality and the practical, it's basically like a practical existentialism.
Whoa.
And it just like, don't make fun.
Nailed it.
But it just like resides in that practical existentialism for the rest of the movie in like a really interesting and like funny sometimes and like kind of sad way at other times. Like it's,
there's like, it's nice when he sort of like starts caring for people at the end of the movie.
Yeah, and I think it earns that in a way that sometimes movies don't. Like there's a real earned and like earnest humanity in the movie. I would recommend it highly.
Mentioned during the clip there, that was my young Michael Shannon.
Yeah, he's in the movie. What's you mentioned this and I didn't know this at the time. So the guy who like, I don't know if he's meant to be the mayor, but he's the guy who's always doing the groundhog announcement is Bill Murray's brother.
Yeah, Brian Doyle Murray.
What? And he's in a ton of stuff. He plays Noah in Wayne's World, who owns Noah's Arcades and mm-hmm. does the rap and has like the most.
He was on SNL for a brief time too.
Really?
He's got like, well, he's got like seven siblings.
Yeah, and he's also older and responsible. Like he basically got Murray into Second City,
right.
And that's where Murray got his start, was in Chicago and Second City and stuff right. like that.
Murray's still not like, I can't watch any of that early SNL though.
Yeah, it doesn't get good till Eddie Murphy comes on, I don't think. Like he's the first modern guy who like starts to carry the show in an interesting way.
Yeah, I mean Murray's probably, there are some things that are funny, but one thing I do like about this movie is the guesses on how much time he actually spends.
Yeah, well, you said it was like something like 10 years, right? That people have estimated.
Yeah, people, and some people have estimated even more than that.
Like
30 years.
The big estimate comes from him like becoming a master of piano, and that takes, you know, 10,000 hours, and presumably he's going for 1 hour lessons every day. So 10,000 days breaks into how many years?
Right.
1,003. I'm not doing good math here. That would be like, yeah, that's where 30 years would come from.
Right. But some people, like, some of the actors thought they read the script and they thought it was like 8 days.
Yeah, I always assumed it was like a year or two, or like maybe not even. Maybe
I thought it was like a few weeks.
Yeah, I think I thought it was like 200 days. But then when you start to like, I mean, that's kind of an absurd exercise.
Again,
but
the movie doesn't really care about how long.
Yeah, and they stop like sort of, I think by day three, they start blurring them together and jump, like doing more jump cuts where you just like, you stop seeing him wake up every day and you just start and seeing.
The probably deliberate like choice, I bet you a line that some people would have wanted him to say is like telling Andy McDowell how many days that he's spent doing this.
Yeah. Do you think you would count if you were him?
Yeah, after a while. Yeah. I would start counting after like
a week?
Oh yeah, for sure. It would be like prison.
How would you count though? You'd have to just remember.
Well, you probably forget after a while because every day felt the same.
And everything resets in terms of like physical objects in the area. So you
probably forget, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
you have nothing to measure it against.
Yeah, you couldn't like make marks on the wall being like, I've been here this many days or anything like that.
Yeah.
Very interesting conversation. really delved into the heart of the movie. You know what is a good joke that I like in this movie that they throw in right at the end? Is that the day that he finally wakes up and it's different, they still play I Got You, Babe. Like the guy messes up and plays it again at the same time, the same morning.
Yeah,
it's a good little joke. I think even that inclusion is like waking up every day to I Got You, Babe would make you so nauseous. Like, yeah. I like that he can't like reset his alarm either. He can never sleep in. Like the alarm is always ordained to go off at 6 a.m. to I Got You, Babe.
He starts smashing it. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Pretty silly.
Do you think there's been like a better or more endearing career left turn for an actor than Bill Murray, like with Rushmore?
Is Rushmore that big of a left turn? I guess that was the first time he fully deadpanned it, eh?
Well, he was in like Ed Wood, for example. He had been in
Ed
couple.
Wood any good? I've been wanting to rewatch Ed Wood for a while.
I watched him like when I was like in the 90s. At some point, I watched it and thought it was good.
Yeah, that's when I watched it.
But I remember I really liked Johnny Depp with the band, Tim Burton.
That's where I wonder if it's good. Like, I haven't seen it since the 90s either when I liked Johnny Depp.
It's probably, like, one of the less wacky, more straight
Ed Wood's just
Burton
like
movies.
A crappy B-movie guy, right? He's like a B-movie director who goes nowhere kind of thing.
Yeah, it's based on a real person.
Is it based on the guy who made Hell Comes to Frogtown and all those? No, because Ed Wood's like older.
Ed Wood's a real person, I think.
But it's set in like the 50s, right? He's like a B-movie director from the 50s.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Hell Comes to Frogtown?
It's about this guy who just makes these horrible movies but has this unwavering positivity about it.
That sounds interesting.
It is.
Where were we
But
on?
Really, Murray, in terms of lead roles, he's done Rushmore and Lost in Translation. And I love Zizou. I think you really like Zizou, right?
Yeah.
But not everybody does. And that's kind of it. Everything else is either a movie that's sort of...
Are you talking about beloved roles for him, or what are you trying...
Like, since he's become, like, this...
I think Broken Flowers.
Broken Flowers, to an extent, but he's in a lot of movies that don't... Like, I stopped going to watch Bill Murray movies just because Bill Murray was in them, you know what I mean? There was a period of time where I started to watch... I was interested in any Bill Murray movie, especially after Lost in Translation.
Yeah. You know what movie is, like, just okay, but he does his thing really well in it?
Right.
St. Vincent.
Yeah. Like, I don't know
It's too much a little bit of, like, just a feel-good movie kind of thing.
Right.
Where he, like, and that's, like, the direction it takes, but it's good. He's good in it. He got a lot of press for Hyde Park on Hudson as well, which I never saw, but people were into it.
Yeah. I think he got a nomination, Golden Globe nomination.
Yeah.
What do you think of the Bill Murray sort of legend these days?
Like the way he like wanders into house parties and is just like invite
the like putting his hands over people's eyes and then when they turn around he says no one will ever believe you and runs away. That's a great story, but I feel like
I feel like it's too easy for him at this point or something. Like he gets to do that because. Like, I like that he does that. I think it's funny, and I think it's great. And, like, I'm glad that he's, like, a pretty, like, human guy who's not way up on his, like, celebrity or, like, you know, into something, like... He's into, like, just kind of messing with people, which sort of seems to be what he's always been into.
But now it seems like he's been reduced to, like, a BuzzFeed list. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah. I think the newest movie, too, is, like, the worst thing... Like, I think he needs to take another left turn. Like, star in, like, an absolute comedy where he goes, like, zany or something like that.
Zombieland cameos that don't really do it anymore.
Yeah, and this new movie, it's just like, I'm Bill Murray and I'm phoning it in. And, like, you know, I think that if he needs to take another left turn.
I think, but what's that movie that you just talked about? The Hyde
Park on Hudson?
Yeah. I think he's tried to do, and I think St. Vincent, like, he's trying to actually do prestige movies.
Yeah.
And they're just not landing.
I mean...
I think they're all kind of... they've been respected.
Yeah.
But he hasn't, like, had...
none of them have been big.
No. He hasn't done, like, since Zizou, in my opinion, like, a really good starring role movie.
Yeah. I think it would be wrong to... Well, maybe Zizou, but, like, he's not the star of Rushmore by any stretch.
He kind of is.
He's not even close to the star.
No, but he's second billing.
Yeah.
Schwartzman's the star, but the movie is love triangle.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I don't even know if he has the second most screen time. Like, it might be Miss Cross and Schwartzman, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he probably has, like, 20 minutes in the movie.
Do you know what his salary was for Rushmore?
A mil.
$9,000.
Oh, good for, like, see, that kind of stuff I can get behind.
And there's a scene involving a helicopter that cost $25,000, and he paid for it.
Did he just really like Wes Anderson? Was he just down?
I think he just believed in it.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if he had seen Bottle Rocket.
Yeah, but that's still pretty cool that he saw Bottle Rocket and was just like, you know what, let's do this. I'm in. Like, I think you're great.
I remember seeing the trailer for the TV spot trailer for Rushmore when Rushmore was coming out, and I remember like how weird it looked.
Yeah.
It just looked strange and unlike any other movie. But it had Bill Murray, who was recently in like Space Jam. And I was just like, this looks cool. And like the best scene of Rushmore is when he blocks the basketball.
Yeah, he's talking on his cell phone. The guy tries to shoot the little kid and he just, yeah.
And I had watched that in the trailer and it was like the only time I'd ever laughed out loud at a movie trailer.
Yeah, that's a classic Murray thing that I'm sure he either like said, let's do, like basically was like, that happened on the spot. That wasn't in the script. And he was like, here's what I want.
No. Wes Anderson script, like, those things are meticulous.
You don't think that you think that was in the script, that, like, Murray's, there's going to be a kid playing basketball who's going to take a shot, and Murray's going to block the shot?
I guarantee that was in the script.
I almost guarantee the opposite. Do we want to play any more clips, or do we want to just move on to Smith's?
We can just move on to Smith's. I think one thing we should also mention is the 1-800 number for Bill Murray.
What's the 1-800 number for Bill Murray?
For, like, almost, like, I don't know, a long time now, a decade if not two decades, he's not had a publicist or, like, an agent.
Yeah.
So if you want Bill Murray to work on something you're doing, you have to call an 800 number with a voicemail and leave a voicemail and hope he gets back to you. That's not even a joke.
No, I believe you. I believe you 100%. I just think it's funny. What song do you want to start with?
I like Cemetery Gates. You like Cemetery Gates too,
right? Let's do Cemetery Gates. I guess that's kind of, let's do it, but it's kind of a weird one. I think it's less than top five most prominent songs.
We'll talk about it.
All right. Here we go, Cemetery Gates off the Smiths.
I dreaded sunny days, so I'll meet you at the cemetery gates. Keats and Yeats are on your side. I dreaded sunny days, so I'll meet you at the cemetery gates. Keats and Yeats are on your side. Wild, wild is on mine. So we go inside and we gravely read the stones. All those people, all those lives, where are they now? With love and hate and passions just like mine. They were born and then they lived and then they died. Seems so unfair, I want to cry. Throws the sundown salutation to the dawn, and you claim these words as your own. But I've read well and I've heard them said 100 times, maybe less, maybe more. If you must the right pros and points, the words you use should be around. Don't plagiarize or take on loan. But there's always someone somewhere.
All right, so that song's called Cemetery Gates.
I think it's my favorite on the record.
Really? It's good. I like it.
It's just like the most concise. Like, it's like chipper. It's like singable.
Yeah, it's also really bizarre subject matter. Like, let's go to the cemetery. Let's hang out in the cemetery. Let's quote poetry at each other, and then I'll call you out for the ones that are like, basically, let's quote poetry, but then if it's not original.
I read that it's like a response to his critics who say that he would steal stuff from other writers.
It's also apparently a slag at the guy who ran Rough Trade at the time, who, like in trying to relate to Morrissey, like was like, I write poetry too. And then, like, you know, Morrissey's like, F you. Where do you want to start with this? Do you want to talk about, like, where this exists in the Smiths catalog? Do you want to talk about Morrissey as, like, the most bizarre public figure?
How much do you know about the Smiths? You could do a little background.
I don't know like, a lot.
Where is this in their catalog, then? It's
third record.
Yeah.
So they had the Smiths self-titled. They had Meet His Murder. This is their third record. This is their biggest record, and it's their second to last. After this, they do Strange Ways, and then they start really, like, plummeting.
And they've got, like, compilations, like, Louder Than...
Yeah, they have a ton of singles that come out, like, in and around this. Like, they're one of the last great... I don't know what the right word is for that, but, like, there obviously was a phenomenon at a certain time in pop music when bands would put out singles and records, and you could only get the singles as singles or as compilations, and the Smiths had a ton of singles. Like, so if you were, like, an obsessive collective, I think they even reissued a box set of it at some point, but something like 37 inches that the Smiths put out along the way. And some of those songs are collected on, like, The World Won't Listen and Louder Than Bombs, which are... The World Won't Listen is 18 songs.
Is that a normal thing for 80s British pop bands?
I mean, the Smiths or The Cure had a lot of singles too, but I think a lot of those still ended up on albums.
Yeah.
But you can go to record stores all the time and find Cure singles everywhere. I think a big part of it was, like, A, radio. So you had to, like, send singles around for radio. B,
I guess New Order too, right?
Yeah, New Order's another band that's very like the Smiths, where their singles are not on their records. So, like, Temptation is not on a record.
Except for, like, reissue, like, American reissues of CDs and stuff.
Yeah, but it's still on, like, the bonus tracks on the second CD. It's not, like, on the, like, standard track listing of the
Blue Monday is... Temptation's on Movement.
But Temptation is not on Movement. Temptation's on Brotherhood.
What am I thinking of?
You're thinking of Ceremony.
Yes.
But Ceremony, yeah, Ceremony's a single. It's not on the Movement record. Temptation's a single. It's not on Brotherhood. Blue Monday was written around the Power Corruption and Lies era, but it's not on Power Corruption and Lies.
I have a Meet Is Murder copy that has How Soon Is Now on it.
Yeah, which is another weird thing. The British copy of How Soon Is Now doesn't have, or the British copy of Meet Is Murder doesn't have How Soon Is Now. The U.S. version does. The Beatles were kind of like that too. Like, they have a lot of songs that never made it onto records, and they're also doubly weird because up until, I think, Revolver, there was different versions of the U.S. records and the British records. So if you buy the U.S. Rubber Soul, it has songs like I've Just Seen a Face. Do you know about this weird thing? Basically, like, Bob Dylan was starting to break in the States, and like, folk music was big, so they tried to like repackage Rubber Soul as more of a folk record. So they took off like Taxman and started with I've Just Seen a Face, and put like You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, I think, is on that one as well. They like
originally on Help, right?
Yeah, they stripped it of certain songs and added like folkier ones to try to like pitch it as a folk record to the U.S. market. It seems crazy that that stuff happened and the bands had like that little say, and they're like, I feel like now bands would just lose their minds if the record label like arbitrarily like repackaged their record and released it in a different format in the States, like after you spent that much time like tracking it and setting the track listings and all that stuff.
Putting like Gold Digger on Yeezus.
Yeah. So the Smiths, Morrissey. So leading into this record, I think this is a good place to start at least. They were going to battle with their record company because they put out a few singles over that like maybe year, like 1985, leading into this record, that just didn't do very well. Like Shakespeare's Sister was one of them. The Boy with the Thorn in His Side was another one. And none of those really charted terribly well. And Morrissey just blamed Rough Trade and the music press and like CBC or BBC all around, just like slagged everyone off in every media outlet that would like print or listen, and just like has like these very infinitely quotable things that he would say. I can't remember any of the quotes, but like you could very easily make a headline that like reads as very controversial, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was always getting in trouble.
Yeah, and still is.
Yeah, still is. Yeah, he's not the most savvy public figure.
He's a maniac.
Yeah.
He's exactly the public figure he wants to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right.
It's just not appealing at all.
He got away with it through the 80s and 90s because he was taking on, I think, legitimate institutions that maybe needed to be taken on, like the Thatcher government and like, you know, the monarchy generally and all this kind of stuff. And that was like a real thing in Britain. But now that it's like 2000 and he's like
calling Chinese people a subspecies,
taking on the Chinese as a race, like it seems a lot more, or like as an ethnic group.
I mean, we're not going to start talking about the ethics of eating meat, but like, I don't think the answer to that is to then be, to just denounce an entire race of people.
Yeah, to dismiss an entire country / ethnic group as being a subhuman species.
Yeah. But yeah. His answer was essentially like, well, stop eating meat then.
Did I tell you about this piece about Morrissey too? That there's like this weird's not the right word. That sounds more pejorative than I wanted to. But a very like strong and vibrant Latino subculture in Los Angeles that loves Morrissey.
You did tell me that.
And it's like a bizarre thing because like that culture, like sort of like, you know, if you grew up in Los Angeles, like Latino subculture, it's like a very like macho culture.
Yeah.
And then Morrissey is like the anti-macho. And I've spent a long time trying to think about what it might be about Morrissey that like people like drive towards. And I think it might be that there's like a vulnerability that has no like sexuality around it, if that makes sense. Because he's not like outright gay. He claims to be like celibate and non-sexual, almost like that sort of, yeah. I mean, there's been things revealed about
deliberately him. He's deliberately vague about it.
Yeah,
very calculated person. I kind of don't like Morrissey at all.
He doesn't seem terribly likable. He's like a pouty, like,
I can't necessarily denounce the way that he projects himself. Like, he's certainly probably an intelligent person who knows what he's doing.
Yeah,
but like when he said something like basically, you know, writes off all black music.
Did he say that?
No, but like he wrote off like all reggae.
Okay.
And since like said he, you know, it was something he said tongue in cheek. Like you can see him saying something like, you know, all reggae music is vile, and then just sort of licking his chops at like whatever the reaction's going to be at that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it does seem like he says things to be deliberately provocative and is like sort of careless to the consequences of what he might say or, like, you know, what people might think.
Right. And I, you know, I don't really know what to think about that. I just know I don't. It's like he's deliberately trying to sort of be
provocative,
an interesting person,
yeah,
as opposed to a relatable person.
Yeah. He doesn't seem like a very real person or someone who ever really says what he means or thinks. And I don't even know if he knows what he thinks or means. You know what I mean? He, like, it almost seems like his personality is like,
he wants to be Oscar Wilde.
Yeah. What he can, like, get people to react to, but, like, doesn't, like, I don't know who Morrissey is in the privacy of his own home, like, when he's just being himself.
Which is exactly what he wants, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I don't know that he knows either, you know what I mean? Like, he can only exist in the public eye as, like, a reflection of things that, like, he says or something.
Yeah, but it's on, those are on terms of, like, us trying to figure out what a celebrity is like based on, like, their interviews and stuff.
Yeah, here's a question I have. Like, obviously, that doesn't affect my liking of the Smiths. I like the Smiths a lot. I think they're great. I think the singles, like, on Louder Than Bombs are incredible. I think this record's incredible. I really like Meat Is Murder. Like, the Smiths self-titled is pretty good. It's not great. Strange Ways Here We Come has some great songs on it. But they have probably, like, 30 songs that I think are, like, great.
Yeah.
And then, like, 10 that are, like, lights out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, like, a high number for any band.
But there is, but to be fair, there is a light that never goes out.
Zing.
Whoa.
Do you think had you grown up in the 80s and had listened to him talk, though, you would hate the Smiths? Like, basically, we've never had to deal with Morrissey fully in, like, the cultural eye in the way that you would have had to if you grew up in Britain.
Hard to say.
In the 80s.
It's interesting because there are few bands that are as iconic and sort of acclaimed as the Smiths that I only like a little bit. I kind of only like the Smiths a little. I like this record, but not all of it. I like the songs that I like on this record a lot. I like most of Meat Is Murder, but less than this record.
Yep.
And then I listened to, you know, Louder Than Bombs recently. I listened to Strange Ways today. You know, good songs here and there, but I find them pretty boring.
They can be pretty hit or miss. Like, their good songs are great, their bad songs are pretty forgettable.
And a band, just to sort of measure them to something, like, a band that they've often get compared to is The Cure.
Yeah.
Who I like in every way more than them.
Really?
Even lyrics.
I was gonna bring up The Cure, but I didn't. Were The Cure who was bigger?
Smiths, I would say, are bigger.
You think so? The Cure are bigger now. Like, The Cure have songs that get played on FM radio now in a way that the Smiths don't. So you would hear Friday I'm in Love, you hear Close to Me, you might hear, like, Just Like
I Him. Think Friday and I'm in Love was maybe a changing point for The Cure.
Yeah, it was a later day hit, too. That's from, like, the 90s.
People didn't care about Morrissey going solo in the States, but the Cure.
Maybe The Cure, like, staying together helped their longevity a little bit too. They were also around longer, like, their first record's from 79, and they're still a band, obviously. And they were putting out records that mattered in, like, the late 80s and early 90s, where the Smiths have a much more compressed, like, time of relevance. I think it's like 82 or 90. Maybe. When does the Smiths self title come out? 82?
Yeah, early 80s.
82 to 87 is, like, you know, by Strange Ways, they're done.
Yeah.
So they have, like, a five-year window.
But, like, even I way rather hear somebody pull off the lyrics to Close to Me, like The Cure.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, doesn't sound too cheesy. It just, they make it sound natural, kind of.
Yeah.
I'd way rather listen to those lyrics than, like, the stuffiness of, like, Vicar in a tutu. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't care what the value is. Like, it's just...
Do you think... The only thing I'll say for the Smiths that I think people really related to is that, like, especially on this record more than any, was a takedown of every, like, revered British institution at once. You know what I mean? Like, British politics, the monarchy, the church, like, all these, like, very, like, core, like, identifiable British pieces. And I think that was very relatable to British. Like, if you were, like, a kid, this is another thing too. Sorry, I'm kind of trailing off, but I had this theory today where it was like punk broke in the 70s and it was a very political thing. Like, the Clash were, like, it's all, like, world politics. And then you have, like, the Sex Pistols, which were kind of, I mean, God Save the Queen and Anarchy in the UK are ostensibly, like, they're stupid, but they're political songs. You know what I mean? And then a band like the Smiths come around and they are just like irreverent in every way, and like taking on like not only politics but like vegetarianism, and like
taking on vegetarianism,
yeah, taking on like meat eating, that's a silly one, but like taking on the church, taking on like sexuality, taking on like all sure. these things that you know what I mean, like you had like your average British male is like, I'm straight, I go to church, I like believe in the Queen, I voted Thatcher, and like Morrissey is just taking it all on, and I think people related to that and got behind that.
Yeah, and I can see that.
He didn't do it.
But I didn't exist as a, you know, a British kid
in the 80s.
Like, I don't really care about British politics, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You have to force me to sort of, like, pay attention to that.
Well, I think that might have been why The Cure broke in America, too, in a way that The Smiths kind of never did, is that The Cure are, like, a little bit more universal.
Universal.
Like, it's just love songs or, like, depressing songs or songs about love cats.
You're right.
I love cats.
I also just like The Cure more because they were way more dynamic. They had way more different kinds of songs.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one.
Their pop songs were just way better, too.
Yeah, their best songs are great.
The Smiths have obviously great songs, especially on this record, Boy with a Thorn, Light Never Goes Out.
Like, yep.
Those songs are amazing. I'm not going to poo-poo them.
Yeah.
But there's also sort of like this weird exclusive club mentality to liking The Smiths. Like, if you liked The Smiths, like, that was your identity.
Yep.
I think for a lot of people growing up.
Can we talk about a weird thing that, like, I don't know how to describe. So Morrissey has a hate on for fat girls in a way that's bizarre. Like, where these are lines from Morrissey song, or like Smith/Morrissey songs. There's a song called, or basically there's a line in William, It Was Really Nothing, where he says, like, how can you stay with a fat girl, who'll say, and then keep singing, some girls are bigger than others. Mm-hmm. He's got a song in his solo career called You're the One for Me, Fatty.
Yeah.
And then he has, like, other songs where he's, like, attacking people. Like, it's like, how can you, or like, I don't know what song, oh, Ask, do you know that song?
No.
It's like something to the effect of, like, spending warm summer days indoors writing frightening verse to a buck-toothed girl in Luxembourg. Like, he's very, like, physical imperfections, especially being not skinny, are things that he attacks in a really, like, vicious way that's bizarre to
but
me.
But it's also, it doesn't strike me as being that vicious. It seems pretty hoity-toity. Like, there's a difference between, like, sticking your nose up at something, which I think he does, and, like, headbutting somebody about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess it's just bizarre.
I kind of choose Rage Against the Machine every time over The Smiths. You know what I mean?
I feel like they're
both political.
I'm talking about his like body issue stuff though.
No, I know, but like it's still like the same sort of behavior. Like he's overly wordy. Like calling somebody a fatty is like, it just seems so silly to me. It doesn't seem vicious. It seems like, okay.
Yeah. I guess, I don't know. He's just a weird guy. Let's maybe leave it at that. Have you read the interviews or like, I watched this thing, but, I think he's talking about, like, I never had no one ever, but, like, he's, like, being in an interview, like, being like, what did you grow up in, like, Manchester doing? He's just like, oh, I did nothing. I would go home and I would sit in my room and I would read, like, these really pretentious books and I would watch TV and right. I had no friends.
Right.
And, like, but he's, like, very, like, wears it like a badge of courage or a badge of courage, like a badge of pride almost or a badge of honor that, like, he... Like, he thinks it's, like, almost glamorous to have been, like, a loner and a loser the way he was. And I'm not saying that, like, it's not, but it's, like, just a bizarre public persona to, like,
yeah, it's all assume. It's always a projection.
Let's play one more song, and then let's get out of here. What do you want to hear?
Whatever you want to hear.
Let's play There's a Light That Never Goes Out.
That's a good one.
Okay, here we go.
Take me out tonight. Cause I haven't got one anymore. Take me out tonight, because I want to see people and I want to see life. Driving in your car, oh please don't drop me home, because it's not my home, it's once let off and I'm welcome no more. And if a double-decker bus crashes into us,
all right, so Mopey, you know, gonna die with somebody.
What are your thoughts on Marr?
He's like a great guitar player. I think that, like, I don't want to say overrated, but
I do.
But maybe, okay, here's what I'll say about Johnny Marr. The amount of people who are like, oh my God, Johnny Marr is a genius guitar player, but can't really articulate why, is bothersome to me.
I mean, the only reason why is tone.
Tone, and he's got like interesting riffs. Like the riff to This Charming Man is pretty cool, and he like had a unique way of playing where it was like sort of like all about like different like chord voicings. Like he basically didn't have like he didn't play blues riffs. I think maybe that's the big thing. He was like the first really big guitar player who wasn't based in any sort of like blues tradition. You know what I mean?
He kind of like the he did like some Birds type stuff. Like yeah, basically it was like a take. A lot of them was seemed like a take on like those mid-60s Bird like riffs.
You think so?
Kind of. Well, just mean, like the strumming of
he didn't have a 12-string, so that's where the Bird sound comes from. I can see what you're saying, but yeah, he did that without a 12-string, so that's why it's like a little bit harder maybe.
Anyways, I don't know. I feel like I'm sounding like I hate the Smiths a lot more than I do. But well, that's sort of what I've been focusing on the past couple of days.
What do you like about them?
I'm just sort of like listening to them and stewing.
They're a weird band because like I don't listen to them and I'm just like, this is universally brilliant. They have a lot of skippable songs. Like they're like if you were inundated in the Smiths, you could grow to resent it very quickly. It's absurd. But like if you can embrace that absurdity, it's really funny and fun sometimes. I mean, like a song like Panic is one of the funniest, best songs. Or a song like what's the one, Girlfriend in a Coma?
Yeah.
Like, that's hilarious. That's a great song.
Yeah, they're good songs. Yeah. I like this record a lot. I mean, you're just playing, you know, Light That Never Goes Out, and, like, obviously that's a great song.
Yeah.
But there's sort of this vibe to the Smiths that...
They're just jerks. I think Johnny Marr is crazy full of himself, probably, as, like, the best guitar player. Morrissey is crazy full of himself as, like, the best singer, and his public persona is absurd. Yeah. Being the other two guys in the Smiths was probably horrendous. Is it Andy Rourke? Is that the bass player?
Yeah.
He, like, started doing heroin before this record came out, like, in Ireland on the Irish tour. He was, like, on heroin.
Got kicked out.
Got kicked out, but then, like, basically they couldn't find anybody good enough, so they brought him back.
Yeah.
But they got kicked out. I mean, this is like sort of one of those legends that Morrissey denies, and who knows whether it's true, but like left a note on like the windshield of his car being like, you're out of the Smiths, like love Morrissey or something like that. Like something really just like totally jerky. You know what I mean?
Did you ever listen to Morrissey solo stuff?
I've listened to a little bit, like that song, You're the One for Me, Fatty, I've heard, and like a handful of others, but I've never sat there and like...
Listen like, to Bone of Drag or anything?
No, like that's the start of that Ryan Adams record. But yeah, I've never heard, or like, I don't know an album, like all the way through being like, that's a great album. Like, right. You know, that's the best Smiths album or whatever.
Or do you ever listen to anything from like the renaissance of him, like 2004 and onward?
I don't think so.
There's a couple good songs from there too. Especially do you know, what's that album called in 2004?
Viva Hate?
No, that's 90. I don't know. I think it's called You Are a Query.
I'm just making up albums.
He's got like a Tommy gun on the cover.
Of course he does. Should we talk about what we're going to talk about next week and then get out of here maybe?
Yeah.
So Trevor's going to do the show next week. We are doing Home Alone, so it's kind of a Christmas episode. We've never done Home Alone. We've resisted for like, what, a year and... How long have we
been? I think it's because we did Uncle Buck so close to Christmas last year.
Yeah. And we've done a few John Hughes movies at this point. We've done Uncle Buck. Actually, we just done Uncle Buck, right?
Yeah.
We never did Breakfast Club or Planes, Trains or Ferris Bueller or any of those?
No, just Uncle Buck.
What's your favorite John Hughes movie?
Home Alone. Well, like, what do you mean by John Hughes movie? Like he didn't direct Home Alone.
Yeah, so Home Alone counts.
No, Home Alone. Then.
Okay. Not Breakfast Club?
Breakfast Club's okay. Ferris Bueller's my favorite by far. Never mind, sorry.
Cool. And then we are doing the Smashing Pumpkins' Adore.
Very Christmassy.
Do you know anything about that record?
Yeah, I love that record.
Do you? Okay. I've never listened to it. So it's going to be a brand new experience for me.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah. Let's play half of a Smith song, and we'll get out of here. We'll stop talking. What Let's play Frankly, Mr. Shankly. That one makes me laugh.
Yeah.
And I really like...
The last line.
One of my favorite things... we won't get to the last line.
I know.
But you know that really sweet riff that only comes in once in the song?
No.
The oh,
do it with your mouth.
It's about...
That is sweet.
It's about like 30 seconds in, but I really like songs that do one part one time and then never bring it back. I always think that's a cool trick. Oh, okay. Here we go. Whatever, man. Frankly, Mr. Shankly.
Shankly, this position I've held, it pays my way and it corrodes my soul. I want to leave, you will not miss me. I want to go down in musical history. Frankly, Mr. Shankly, I'm a sickening wreck. I've got the 21st century breathing down my neck. I must move fast, you understand me. I want to go down.